You're listening to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor, powered by bbbgive.org. Here, we explore the motivations that form the basis of giving and service. We inspire generosity and celebrate the transformative effects that giving and service have on the human spirit and on community. The conversations featured on the podcast also uncover giving strategies that educate and provide tools to help listeners make impactful gifts of both their time and money. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast, powered by bbbgive.org. Give.org is the nation's standards-based charity evaluator and your one-stop source for information on giving and reports on the most asked-about charities. I am Art Taylor, your host, and with me today is Dan Porterfield, the president and CEO of the Aspen Institute, and this is the second of a two-part interview with Dan. During the first interview, we had an opportunity to discuss some of the great work underway that he's been leading and he has led throughout his career to provide educational access for people from underserved communities to attend some of our nation's most prestigious institutions of higher learning. During this episode, we'll get to discuss with Dan the great work underway at the Aspen Institute, not only in the space of education, but also in many other areas that affect our daily lives. Dan, I know that at the Aspen Institute, where you're working now, education is also a focus, but there are a number of other important areas of focus that you have there that I'd like to hear about. Talk to us a bit about what's going on at Aspen right now.
The Aspen Institute is a global nonprofit that seeks to drive change towards a free, just, and equitable society. And we do that through more than 75 different programs, all with complementary but different theories of change that seek to promote inclusive dialogue, values-based leadership, and action on critical issues of public health, education access, income equality, global stability, and more. The Aspen Institute has been around for 70 years. It was founded after World War II in an era of sort of optimism in the aftermath of tragedy, nuclear war, Holocaust, extraordinary global migration, forced global migration. And the premise of the Aspen Institute is that people of goodwill in the business community, the nonprofit community, the government sector can come together to use reason to come up with solutions to the problems of the day. Some of our work in education focuses on community colleges, which are incredibly important engines of opportunity in our society. We also do a lot of work with efforts to help communities and households have financial stability, either through better first jobs, improved benefits structures, new ways of promoting household savings, so critical for fiscal resilience for families, through job development and through education reform that promotes partnerships between business community and school communities. The Aspen Institute also has more than 14 programs that identify leaders who are between the ages of 35 and 45, who have done great things in their careers at an early age, and challenges them to clarify for themselves and others what their values are and how they'll use their values to promote a more just society. Those programs have graduated an awful lot of people that are important in our society today, including seven people that ran for president of the United States in 2020. And our current vice president, Kamala Harris, is the product of one of our leadership programs, as are two other members of the Biden cabinet.
So I do want to ask a question about one strand of work at Aspen, Dan, around dialogue. We all saw the insurrection, which is what I call it, that occurred at the Capitol, and we were all horrified by what we saw there. And I am still concerned, though, that we haven't yet found a way to effectively create dialogue between groups to the extent where we could actually achieve progress and bring this nation closer together, bridge building. And I'm just curious about your thoughts, Dan, on how we can begin bridging communities of people who obviously have very different views about where this country should go. And I know that you obviously are concerned about this too. What can we do to get people talking? There are families right now that don't talk to each other.
Yeah, this is an enormous challenge across our society. The Aspen Institute is doing work, and it's got promise, but I don't want to promise that it will have effect at scale across 340 million people. But some things that we're doing that are important. One, we have a program that's called Citizenship and American Identity, led by Eric Liu, that has two signature programs within it. One is called Who Is Us, which is fostering conversation around the country about the full array of people that claim American identity, and what they share and how they differ. And second, Eric is leading a project that we call the Better Arguments Project, which is about empowering communities, helping communities to have not fewer arguments, but better arguments, where people acknowledge each other's points of view, can actually recite each other's perspective after hearing it, and practice the art of separating the argument from the person making the argument. Eric has a TED Talk that I would encourage people to watch. It's about this theme of how to have a better argument. A different way we're working is through our project Weave, which is led by a colleague named Fred Riley. And what Fred is doing is identifying in communities all across the country change makers who are on the ground working to bring people together by solving local problems. And it might be that the problem is sort of social disintegration in one place, another place it might be youth suicide, and a third place it might be the need for interreligious dialogue. Fred and his team have identified the individuals working locally to bridge the divides as weavers, reweaving community. And we've created a network of several hundred weavers, and we've begun to interview those weavers and explicate some of the values that they have in common. Values which I would argue are at least as strong as the values that we associate with polarization and demonizing others, but they're not as well seen. You know, one way that you encourage people to find a better way to live is by holding up the people that are living that way and showing the rest of the world how fulfilled and joyful and impactful they are. So the Weavers is the second effort. Still another effort, different, is that it's often the Aspen methodology to pull people together who are in a common field or endeavor and encourage them not to compete against each other, but to compete together towards some larger goal. We staff the Bloomberg-funded American Talent Initiative that I spoke of earlier, through which top schools are being encouraged to compete together to increase Pell Grant enrollment substantially. We staff a biweekly breakfast on Capitol Hill, where we bring into the Capitol a leader who is making a difference in a nonpartisan way on some critical issue, and invite and challenge members of Congress who may hold very different views on a number of issues to see if they can't find agreement on the issue that we're presenting before them, which could be anything from reducing prescription drug costs to strengthening the school-to-work pipeline to understanding better cybersecurity threats to our country from abroad. So those are some of the ways we're working to bridge the divides. One of the hardest things today is that it seems so many people in our country adopt a position not because they hold it, but because another group doesn't hold it, and they want to anger that other group by holding a position that's counter to what they believe. You know, we used to think growing up that, like, Republicans and Democrats, they all want the same thing. They just have a different way of getting there. But now we're seeing something different. It's more identity-based. It's not about holding the same values and having different pathways. It's actually disagreeing with the type or the person, wanting to be on the other side of a faction My faction is my faction. I know it because it's not your faction. And that is really challenging. It does kind of take me back to my childhood and the beginning of this interview when I saw firsthand how a group of families in the neighborhood that I was growing up in viscerally attacked a doctor from Africa and his wife and two little children because they didn't want them in their neighborhood. And I'll never forget seeing that anger, hatred, disgust, whatever it was those people felt towards this innocent family was actually some kind of terrible internal condition that they needed to heal from. I have no idea how really to turn that off, but it feels like it's been ramped up in our society, perhaps because of abusive politicians who are manipulative, and also because of toxic social media, which amplifies fear and hatred, but hasn't really proven itself to be able to amplify love and community. We've got a big challenge ahead of us.
Yes, we do. And one of the areas I'm hoping that we can amplify to assist with some of that challenge is our philanthropic work. And I know Aspen has long had a piece of its work devoted to amplifying philanthropy. And I've had the opportunity to meet with some of your staff there, Jane Wells. And I know that there's an interest in trying to inspire people to give and serve, and that there's concern now, even expressed by some of your team, about what we can do to get people more focused on giving and serving. We've seen a decline in the number of donors over the last decade or so, and we're just hoping that we can do more to inspire people to give and serve. Are you aware of any of that work right now that Jane and her people are trying to start? And we're at a very early stage in it, I know. But I'm just curious if you think there's any promise to what they may be uncovering at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we know that giving and service, along with learning and love, are the ingredients of fulfilled and happy lives. And those that are able to feel that they are sharing, giving, serving, almost always feel gratitude towards those they're serving for allowing them to serve. And we want to foster that spirit in the country. And there are headwinds that we have to fight against or deal with in order to promote service. And one of them is that service can be seen as just putting Band-Aids on problems. And a second can be seen that service can be viewed as condescending if it's not co-created with those that are being served. And a third can be that service is sort of virtue signaling as opposed to authentic engagement. And those are reasonable critiques one should think through. But we need more people getting up and active and giving back in any way they can. There's a story in the gospel, for those that read the gospels, about the poor woman that set the greatest example because she gave not from her excess, but from her deficit. And, you know, that is what we all should be trying to do, is to give so much and so well that we feel we are giving more than we can, more than we should, because we dig deeper with service as an essential gesture of what it means to be a human being. I think one of the things about philanthropy that's tricky right now is that some of the biggest philanthropists have, first of all, accumulated their wealth in ways that reflect inequity. And so that presents a challenge. If the amassing of wealth happens in systems that are now viewed as of questionable legitimacy because of the wealth gap, there then becomes some skepticism about that wealth to begin with. That's one challenge, I think. The philanthropic community has to think out how to deal with the perception that it was inequity that made some of the great endowments and great foundations in the world today. Second, some philanthropies are viewed as very top-down, very directive, condescending, and perhaps investing disproportionately in their vision rather than the vision of those they would seek to help. And so there, I think co-creation is a critical model, and that philanthropists can, should look to really give power and not just resources to the communities they're trying to help. I've been very impressed with Mackenzie Scott Bezos, because she seems to have developed an approach where she is investing in really on the ground efforts to make a difference on critical issues, and is not requiring all these nonprofits she's making generous gifts to spend months developing proposals or even to explain how they'll use the funds that she gives them. That's very refreshing to me. Another important factor is that we've had a lot of philanthropy, a lot of government action, and yet the challenges of the country in many ways have gotten worse and not better. There's greater income inequality. There's a greater education gap between haves and have-nots. There's a greater public health gap. We look at the actual indices of equity in the country, and we don't see progress, even though we've had large philanthropies going at it for a long period of time. I think that what Jane Wells and her team are trying to do is to find models where philanthropy is working in partnership with civil society, the private sector, people on the ground, and government, and to drive change collectively, as opposed to thinking that a philanthropy can do it on its own. And so that requires rethinking theories of change and rethinking ways that philanthropies have used their assets. And that's, you know, not easy, but critically important work.
Absolutely. And you mentioned this whole issue of tainted money. I teach a class at Columbia University in the School of Professional Studies on ethics in the nonprofit sector. And invariably, this question of where the money comes from and whether it was tainted comes up in every class. And ultimately, I have to say to my students that if you looked hard enough, virtually every dollar earned by some wealthy person was tainted somewhere along the way, because, I mean, America was built on a certain degree of taint itself. When you look at the Native Americans who lost their land, and African Americans who built the country on their slave labor. So everything is tainted. So we're, at some point, we're going to have to really be clear about what we mean by that. But I certainly appreciate you bringing that up, because it is a real challenge. Ultimately, Mother Teresa, I think she said, would take money from wherever as long as she could do some good with it. And I think maybe we have to begin thinking differently about it, although I know some of my friends will criticize me for that point of view.
Yeah, it's a challenging time, because on the one hand, it's very good to have critical awareness that we apply to the so-called givens of life and ask ourselves, well, why is it the way it is? What could be different? And on the other hand, is it possible to bend and reform our institutions so that they sustain themselves, but in a way that promotes equity, fairness, and social justice? And I tend to be somebody that believes that institutions can be an anchor of society, and that reforming them from within and without is the best way to make sustainable sort of stability-enhancing change. But others don't accept that view and believe that we should either destroy some of the institutions we have in the country, or that we should call out past practices in such a way that some institutions are no longer seen as legitimate to drive any change. I think that the conversation that goes between those different positions is a critical one. And ultimately, though, for people that want to make change, I believe that being able to have some degree of acceptance, some degree of humility about one's own value system being the best, is very important. And I like to encourage younger people to get into philanthropy and to be ready to accept philanthropic dollars and put them to uses that the philanthropists themselves might not have known to want, but will value when they see those changes happening in the real world. I was a lucky person. I competed and won a fellowship to go to Oxford University that is named for Cecil Rhodes, who oppressed and enslaved thousands and thousands of people through his career mining diamonds. And I believed, I remember at the time when I was being interviewed for this scholarship, one of the interviewers was Kurt Schmoke, who's longtime leader in Baltimore, is African-American, and said, how can you justify taking money in the name of Cecil Rhodes or having a scholarship named for Cecil Rhodes? And although I was tempted to say, well, how could you, since he was a Rhodes Scholar, that would have been a terrible answer. And I thought about it and just said, the truth of the matter is, I hope I can use this scholarship in ways that would make Cecil Rhodes rethink his whole understanding of humanity. I don't know if I've succeeded or not. I don't know if I was rationalizing or not, but I do think that everybody, each of us, is implicated in the injustice of the past and the present. And the most important thing I could do for somebody else is support their efforts to make change and encourage them to do their very best to promote a more just and equitable world.
Amen to that. As we're getting toward the end of the conversation, I want to ask you a couple more questions. One having more to do with sort of the future of our society and mankind for that matter. And I know that you think a lot about that. And the second question is more to do with your passion around education. And if there is maybe a path forward for institutions that want to see opportunity for students to grow and thrive educationally, how we might fund it. Are there different innovations ahead that we might look to enable a lot of this to occur? Many people are talking about the ability that we've acquired now to do learning from a distance. Some people rejected that in total years ago, are now beginning to see that maybe there are some opportunities to use that alongside of some of the more traditional ways of educating people. But I'm also asking the more general question about future optimism or concern about where we are as a society and where we're headed.
So one of the realities is that pessimism and cynicism have never yet, in my experience, actually led to concrete change. That what's needed is the combination of practical optimism, humanism, and hope. And so that's what I try to bring to my efforts and try to support people that have those same commitments. It's especially important that we engage with the young in such a way as to help them to believe that even acting alone, they can make a difference in the lives of others, in the one and the many. And that positive, pro-change, let's make the world better mindset is to me the most powerful force that we humans have. In terms of the future of education, clearly one of the potential benefits from the COVID era is that we have seen virtual learning can work, especially if it is a supplement, I would argue, to high impact in-person learning rather than supplanting high impact personalized learning. I don't think that we have to be face-to-face in person for every learning experience to stick and to be valuable. But I do believe that for undergraduates, for 18 to 22 year olds, being seen and known, valued as the person you are and the person you're changing into is extraordinarily catalyzing. I don't think that 18 to 22 year olds will really draw out their best selves, their deepest learning, if they are 100% of the time sitting on a couch in their basement or in their bedroom learning virtually. I do think in-person education, which is holistic, which is personalized, and which is co-curricular, is the future of, I would say, of human capital development among 18 to 22-year-olds, which doesn't mean we can't have graduate programs that are more virtual. It doesn't mean we can't have training programs that are more virtual. It doesn't mean that employee development programs can't be done virtually. And then in terms of the overall sort of like the signals of challenge that the country needs to be looking at. Of course, there are many. Inequity is one. The pessimism among rising generations is the second. Surveillance capitalism is a third. The rise of nationalism is a fourth. climate change, which looks almost inexorable as a fifth. You know, maybe a sixth might be the rise of totalitarian states around the world. And you look at all those factors, and there's a lot of reason to worry, and I probably left a few out. Okay, and how still does a person get up in the morning and create a meaningful life, given all these forces that seem beyond the reach, not just of any person, but of humanity as a whole? And to me, it comes down to a few core values that have helped me live my life, not in denial of all those factors, but in pursuit of remedies. And one is love, a second is faith, a third is learning, and a fourth is service. And I believe that those four factors, or some combination of them, can give the individual person, you know, a pathway to a meaningful life, even in a world where there are great uncertainties that loom above us all. To me, that's the pathway to a meaningful life. And I don't see how any other pathway gives us solutions to those great problems to begin with. But I know that the other pathways don't really lead to a feeling of meaningfulness. We have to have love, learning, faith, and service in our lives in order, I believe, to experience that kind of personal transcendence and connectedness with others that makes getting up in the morning worth it.
Wow. Dan, thank you so much for that. Love, learning, faith, and service. So let me just thank you for taking this time to join me on this podcast. You've left us with a lot to think about, my friend, and I hope you have continued success in your career, the work you're doing at Aspen, and your passion in education. And let's stay close.
Absolutely. Thank you, Art, for your example, for this podcast, and for all that you do to help build a free, just, equitable, and anti-racist society. Here's to tomorrow.
Here's to tomorrow. Well, thank you for listening to the Heart of Giving podcast. You can find us on all major podcast platforms, and I hope you do. Thanks for listening.
You've just listened to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor. Be sure to tune in next time for a brand new episode. To listen to our other interviews, visit heartgiving.podbean.com. That's heartgiving.podbean.com. Subscribe to our show on major podcast platforms. Send your comments and ideas to Nona@thusmarket.com. That's Nona@thusmarket.com. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guests, not those of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance or program affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Podbean's terms of service.